Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
This is Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer, your host for this week's show. On October 26th, Saskatchewan will hold its provincial election, but the result is pretty much guaranteed. That's because the Saskatchewan Party has a 25-point lead in the polls. On today's show, we'll examine the state of politics in Saskatchewan, discuss a ban on moose hunting in Manitoba, and try to predict where canola prices are headed in the coming months. First up, it's a very safe bet that the Saskatchewan Party will be re-elected next week. The CBC News poll tracker says there's a 99% chance that the SAS Party wins the provincial election. Join us to talk about the dominance of the SAS Party and agricultural issues in the campaign is Karen Briere, a reporter with the Western Producer in Regina. Hey, Karen, thanks for coming on Between the Rows. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
So, as you know, the Saskatchewan Party has been in power since 2007. It's quite a long time for a provincial government, but still they have about, 58% of support in the province, according to recent polls. Can you just sort of share and explain why they still have strong support across the province?
Well, I would say that they're very popular in rural areas still because times have been relatively good. As you mentioned, they came to power in 2007, and that was just the start of an economic boom here in the province. And there have been some highs and lows, but from an agricultural point of view, we saw the highest recorded farm income levels ever during this time. And farmers generally feel that the SAS Party understands their industry and will basically let them run their farms without too much interference. They are aware, I think, that more regulations around the environment and climate change are likely coming at a federal level. And they see the SAS Party as their champion in that regard, in terms of fighting it. And, you know, an example of that would be our government's taking Ottawa to court against the federal carbon tax. So basically, in terms of the cities, I think their support in those areas come from owner-operator businesses and people who sort of subscribe to the same philosophy.
So just to summarize, in rural areas and farmers in farm country, people feel that the SAS Party has their backs, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. The people I've talked to, they, you know, if I say, what has the SAS Party done for you lately? They can't really put their finger on anything specific, but they just have this sense of well-being under them, I guess.
Okay. So we're in a pandemic, as everybody knows, and this is not been a normal election campaign in Saskatchewan. What sort of ag issues or rural issues have popped up during the campaign?
In terms of agriculture, really nothing. There have been no specific campaign announcements from any party on what they would do for the industry specifically. There are nods to the industry in the NDP platform document, in which they said they would, if they formed government, reduce crop insurance costs for new farmers and ante up the approximately $20 million required to remove the reference margin limit from agri-stability. But the SAS Party's platform basically relies on its record on agriculture and notes that it has growth plan targets to increase crop and livestock receipts and production, but doesn't really offer any new ways to do that. In terms of broader rural issues, the number one issue that's come up has been internet and cell phone service, which is spotty everywhere. And the pandemic, of course, as we know, has really highlighted the inadequacies of the infrastructure that we have right now. When you've got farmers trying to run a business and their children home from school and trying to also use the internet to do their classes and that sort of thing. So, you know, parties have all at various times promised to fix that. And we'll see, I guess. SaskTel is increasing the number of towers it's putting up this year, but will it fix the whole problem? I don't know.
Okay. So it sounds like in terms of ag issues in Saskatchewan, the issues are more national things like the carbon tax and as well, you know, international trade disputes and access to markets, that sort of thing, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just a function of the way we work in agriculture now with the 5-year federal provincial agreements on business risk management and those sort of things. And of course, trade being more so country to country when it comes to negotiating some things.
Okay. So I used to live in Saskatchewan in the mid 2000s, and in the area I lived in up in Nipawin, you know, there was like some NDP support. And back then, I believe the NDP did, you know, win a few constituencies in rural areas. Does the NDP have any shot of winning some rural ridings in 2020?
I would say nope. Okay. And they haven't even tried really to make up any ground in rural areas during this campaign. Their stops have focused on the battlegrounds of Regina, Saskatoon, Moose Jaw, and Prince Albert. Because of how the 61 constituencies are distributed, these places will determine the size of the SAS party majority. 29 of seats are considered rural.
Okay.
And so if you win all the rural, you need 2 in the urban areas to win a majority. Regina has 12 seats, Saskatoon has 14, Moose Jaw and Prince Albert each have 2. So that's where seats are kind of up for grabs. The NDP have a long time lock on the 2 northern ridings.
Okay. So what's it been like trying to cover this election? Because in a normal year, you know, you'd be going to campaign events and traveling around more to meet with people. What's it been like for you trying to cover this campaign?
Well, the main difference really is that, yes, there are far fewer in-person events or announcements to cover. I did spend a day on the campaign trail with Agriculture Minister David Merritt while he held 3 physically distant events in on farms, in a shop, in a tire shop, just where we could stand around and maintain distance. You know, there was no shaking hands or you know, getting in each other's faces kind of thing. And they were fairly small numbers of people at these. So I thought that worked well, but that was just one day. And one other difference was there was no in-person agriculture debate this time around. Usually a farm organization like APAS organizes a debate with a representative from each party. And this year they opted for a more of a forum format, and it was recorded virtually with questions supplied ahead of time and that kind of thing. So not something to attend, but to watch.
Okay. So it's from the polls I look at, it seems like the SAS party is pretty much guaranteed to win this election. Is this going to be a complete blowout, or will the other parties, you know, gain maybe a few seats? What's your prediction here?
Well, my prediction is a SAS party majority. They went into the campaign with 46 seats and the NDP had 13, and 2 were vacant, but they had been held by SAS party MLAs who entered federal politics. As you noted, the polls have steadily shown that SAS party support is still strong. And so they could lose 2 or 3 seats in urban ridings, but would still obviously have a strong majority. I think the big question during this election is how well the NDP does. They pretty much have to make some gains, show some progress, that kind of thing, for it and its leader, Ryan Miley, to move forward. I think if they lost any seats, that would be a big deal for the NDP. It's not likely that the Greens, Liberals, PCs, Buffalo Party are going to win.
What's the Buffalo Party?
The Buffalo Party is the independent party, the party that wants to separate Western Canada from Canada. Okay. And they are running candidates provincially in this election. Off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly how many, but not in every riding. And I guess there is some possibility of taking away some SAS party vote in those ridings, but it won't be enough to harm their chances.
Okay. Thanks, Karen. I've been speaking with Karen Briere, a reporter with the Western Producer in Regina. Thanks for coming on the show, Karen. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Next up, Manitoba's government is in a battle with Métis leaders over moose. Earlier this month, Blaine Peterson, the Minister of Agriculture and Resource Development, said the moose population is still too low. So he extended a ban on moose hunting in the province. Here to talk about the ban and the reaction of Métis groups is Gerilyn Wichers, a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator. Hi, Gerilyn. Thanks for coming on Between the Rows.
Hi, Robert.
So, as you know, earlier this month, Manitoba extended a ban on moose hunting in parts of the province. Can you just tell us where moose hunting is banned and why?
Yeah, so back in 2011, Manitoba banned moose hunting in certain areas because the population had dropped to concerning levels. And this encompasses several game hunting areas, or GHAs. But some of the key ones are the Duck Mountain and Porcupine Mountain areas, as well as the Nopaming area and the Turtle Mountain and North Interlake areas.
So do you know what is the principal reason for the ban? Just to maintain moose populations, or what is the issue here?
To allow the population to recover.
Okay, so the issue is that populations have gotten too low, therefore we can't have moose hunting. And, you know, I believe this ban started in 2011. So this is nothing new. This has been going on for a while in Manitoba.
Right. Yeah. 9 years now.
Okay. So some folks, including the Manitoba Métis Federation, are not very happy with this decision. What are they saying about this?
So, as I understand, what this comes down to is the Métis people's constitutional right to traditional moose hunting. In 2011, the Manitoba Métis Federation, the MMF, agreed to the ban on moose hunting in this area, despite their rights to hunt. But this September, the Manitoba Métis Federation said that the province had told them that a limited harvest of 2% or 60 bull moose in the conservation areas would not hurt the moose population. And essentially they felt that they were given the go-ahead for a small hunt this year. And they announced that to the Métis citizens and basically put out a call for hunting parties of, I believe, at least 4 people to apply for these tags. They had 26 tags, I believe, in total. Shortly thereafter, they get this announcement from the province that actually, no, they can't hunt. The ban is still on for everyone. In their perception, a very sharp about face from the province. And they say that the province didn't consult with them adequately, or didn't put an accommodation in place so that they could still hunt as is their right. So in a news release, the Manitoba Métis Federation president, David Chartrand, said that it's time for the hunt to continue in a collective and responsible and controlled manner, is what he said. The rights of the Indigenous peoples to hunt for cultural and food purposes take constitutional priority over the rights of those who hunt for sport, end quote. Okay. So on October 14th, the moose tag draw went forward through a live stream. They gave away bull moose tags to parties of Métis hunters. And in that live stream, the Manitoba Métis Federation's Minister of Housing and Property Management, Will Gooden, told Métis citizens, quote, you are not breaking the law. In fact, it is the province, it is the premier, and it is the minister who will be breaking the law if they charge you, end quote. The Manitoba Métis Federation has said it will protect hunters if they're charged for moose hunting and has called it an issue of rights and self-governance.
So the crux of this issue is the question of Métis First Nations' right to hunt. And then the province's side of the other side of the story is, well, we have a responsibility to conserve wildlife populations, including moose. That's the basic the fault line here.
I think that is the stances that both sides would take, yes.
Okay. So, as you know, there was a press conference with Manitoba's Minister of Agriculture and Resource Development, Blaine Peterson, and, you know, he made it very clear that the province, you know, needs one policy regarding moose and wildlife conservation. What did you take away from the tone and what Minister Peterson had to say in that press conference?
Well, his talking points were pretty clear, that this was about the moose and not about the rights of Métis or First Nation hunters in Manitoba. And he said, you know, if we don't protect the moose, then there will be no moose for anyone, not for Indigenous hunters, sightseers, etc. And he kind of kept on repeating that point. And he didn't address why the change in messaging, or if there was a change in messaging, as Manitoba Métis Federation has said. He just said the province had consulted with the Manitoba Métis Federation about the ban and had records of doing so, and just stuck to a message of it's all about the moose. He kept on saying, you know, it's all about the moose.
Right.
And in some ways, that's exactly what I would expect from this provincial government. They're not really known for being exceptionally forthcoming. I guess it's kind of understandable that the Manitoba Métis Federation would be frustrated with them. What did you take from that, Robert? I think you were at that press conference as well.
Yeah, you know, I think there's more going on here in that there has been quite a few confrontations in the last couple of years between the Progressive Conservative Government of Manitoba and the Manitoba Métis Federation. And there's been a lot of nasty words exchanged in the media back and forth. And so there is a bit more of a context here. Obviously, these two groups, the Manitoba Métis Federation and the Progressive Conservative Government, you know, don't have a great relationship. So obviously, you know, having successful consultations on something like a moose hunt, you know, is more challenging when you don't have a good relation to begin with. So, Yeah. But obviously there's other groups here that also have opinions about this, such as the Manitoba Wildlife Federation. What are they saying about the possibility of a Métis moose hunt this fall?
They're definitely not pleased that the Manitoba Métis Federation issued tags to some of their citizen hunters. They said in a statement that the Métis Federation has no legal authority to do this, and that all user groups need to abide by one management strategy. And they also definitely took exception to being called recreational hunters. In the same statement, they said, quote, we're all in the same boat. We hunt to fill our freezers and support our families, end quote. And they made it clear that if the hunt goes ahead, they're going to advocate to the province for prosecution against those hunters.
Okay. So we have some groups saying there needs to be this needs to be fully prosecuted and people have to be charged if there's a moose hunt. And then, of course, the Manitoba Métis Federation is saying, well, you know, you are in the legal right. You can go ahead. You're fine, sort of thing. So there's sort of like some large legal questions here about whether or not this is something the Métis people can actually do or not.
Yeah.
Okay. So This story is obviously somewhat connected to what's happening in Nova Scotia right now with the issues between Indigenous lobster fishermen and non-Indigenous fishermen. What will you be watching for in the coming weeks regarding this moose hunt? Are you thinking there might be confrontations between groups like the Manitoba Wildlife Federation and Métis hunters? What are you expecting?
Well, I'm definitely concerned about that. Like you said, I have been watching what's been going on with the lobster, the Mi'kmaq lobster fishermen on the East Coast and the ugly confrontations that have been going on there. And of course, there's been nothing to suggest that's going to happen here. But at the same time, the Manitoba Métis Federation has been very open about what they're doing. They've issued these tags to their hunters. And so I will definitely be looking for if anyone ends up interfering with these hunts in some way, be it, you know, nonviolent interference, like scaring away game. I don't really know. Are we going to see conservation officers attempt to stop them? Are we going to see non-Indigenous hunters interfere? I'm certainly concerned and hope this comes to a peaceful and productive resolution. Also, I am curious if any other groups are going to follow suit. The Southern Chiefs organization has given its support to the Manitoba Métis Federation and also spoken out against being banned from moose hunting. But I have seen nothing to indicate that they are going to be going forward with their own moose hunt. And then also very shortly on the heels of the moose hunt ban, and then also at the same time, the government announced the passing of a new law that added restrictions to night hunting. Uh-huh. And made that explicitly illegal. And very short on the heels of that, they put on a news release saying that they had already caught hunters under those laws. So I'm kind of curious if they're going to be as quick to toot their own horns when it comes to moose hunting bans.
Okay. Thanks, Gerilyn. I've been speaking with Gerilyn Witchers, a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator, about a ban on moose hunting in Manitoba. Thanks, Gerilyn.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This is Robert Arneson, your host this week for Between the Rows. For our next item, we're taking a closer look at fall fertilizer management in a special feature sponsored by Nutrien. Here is Grain News editor Carrie Belanger and Nutrien agronomist Christy Preston.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carrie Belanger, editor of Grain News, and I'm here with Christy Preston, who has a PhD in soil fertility and is a senior agronomist with Nutrien. Today, we're taking a closer look at the relationship between organic matter, soil types, the availability of sulfur to your crops, and how much sulfur you need to apply and when. Welcome, Christy. Thanks so much for being here today.
Good morning, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Christy, would you explain the relationships between organic matter and plant available sulfur?
So what farmers need to know is the majority of sulfur that's in the soil is present as organic matter, but that organic matter has to be broken down before those nutrients are plant available. So organic sulfur has to be converted to sulfate before it's plant available. But a lot of times a farmer might not necessarily see sulfur deficiencies in his field because he has high organic matter. So say above 3% organic matter, a lot of times we don't see sulfur deficiency.
So are there soil test methods for determining sulfur availability?
Some states here in the U.S. do have recommendations of sulfur application rates based on soil tests. But for the most part, they're not highly recommended because sulfate sulfur is mobile within the soil profile. Now, Kansas in particular requires, say, a profile or a 0 to 24 inch sample. And I think it's around 6 parts per million is the cutoff point to where you need applications. But again, since sulfur is so mobile within the soil profile, it's hard to pinpoint how much sulfur is actually needed using a soil test method.
So what should farmers focus on instead?
We recommend that farmers focus on uptake rates and removal rates within the harvested portion of the plant.
Could you explain these terms for us?
Yeah, so they're completely different. The amount of uptake that a plant needs to maximize yield or to reach a certain yield level is a lot higher than what's being removed in the plant, in the plant portions that are being harvested. So grain or tissue in some crops. So the difference between the two is the nutrients that are going to be recycled into the soil. So you've got the total amount taken up, then you've got the amount removed, and then you will have some portion of the nutrients that were taken up that will be recycled. However, we need to focus on those nutrients that are leaving the field, that are removed in, say, grain or tissue harvest. So both the uptake values and the removal coefficients are used to calculate something that we call the harvest index. Now, this gives a farmer an idea of the portion of uptake that is being removed. So say for a corn crop that is producing 230 bushels per acre will take up around 23 pounds of sulfur, but will remove about 13 pounds. And so the calculated harvest index is about 57%. And what that tells a farmer is that 50% of the sulfur that is taken up within the plant is going to be removed at harvest time. And that should give the farmer an idea of how much needs to be applied, because we at least want to apply what is being removed from the soil.
What about, how does the crop's need for sulfur vary during the growing season? Because that will also have an effect, will it not?
It will. Some research has shown that 50% of the sulfur taken up occurs after the plant enters reproductive phases. So say a canola field that has just reached flowering might begin to show some sulfur deficiencies because it's increasing the amount that it's taken up. And if there's not enough sulfur applied, then that plant is going to show those deficiency symptoms. But again, if the organic matter is high enough, those soil temperatures are going to be high enough that that organic matter will be breaking down some and supplying sulfur. But a lot of times, farmers need to apply supplemental sulfur using fertilizers.
I see. So how can farmers manage this timing of the sulfur needs of the crop?
The best thing a farmer can do is to ensure that there is some sulfur available early in the growing season, but then also make sure that there is some sulfur available later in the growing season whenever the crop's taken it up the most. Now, Nutrient has a new product, Smart Nutrition Mat Plus MST, where the sulfur is present as an elemental form, so the oxidation process to make sulfate sulfur plant available will take a little bit of time, so the fertilizer acts as a slow-release sulfur source. So we suggest that farmers maybe apply something like ammonium sulfate to ensure early season availability, and then have that prolonged availability with the elemental sulfur in Mat Plus MST.
Thanks, Christy. That really makes sense. Now, what if farmers or agronomists want more information? Where can they find it?
More information can be found at smartnutritionmst.com.
Thanks so much, audience, for listening to this special feature sponsored by Smart Nutrition MAP Plus MST from Nutrien. And thank you so much, Christy, for being here with us today.
Thank you, Carrie.
On October 19th, canola futures were creeping close to $540 per ton. That's the highest price since June of 2018. But this isn't really news, as canola has been climbing for the last 5 months. Join us to chat about canola prices and other news from the commodity markets is Phil Franz Workington, a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm. Hey, Phil, thanks for coming on Between the Rows.
Thanks for having me.
So I just checked the canola futures prices, 15 minutes ago. And what I saw was that the January contract is now at around $539 per ton. So can you talk about what's going on here? I mean, prices are higher than they've been in, 2 years and about whatever, 4 or 5 months. So why is canola so strong right now?
Yeah, it's touching right at those, the highs of 2 years. And if you look at like a longer term chart, aside from a brief blip a couple of years ago, we're almost nearing, we could easily break out to 7 year highs if this keeps up. A lot of it has to do with just tracking the outside markets. Beans, like soybeans, have been strong as well. Malaysian palm oil has been seeing some strength. So that sort of rising tide sentiment has helped underpin canola. And a lot of it is speculative fund money has kind of been pouring into a lot of the agricultural commodities right now. And that is supporting the canola futures as well. So yeah, it's right near some multi-year highs, and after a couple of weeks of almost sort of consolidating in a narrow range, that's helped take out some of the overbought sentiment in the market. So there's it will take outside influences to keep the trend pointing higher, but for now, the trend is pointing higher, although that 540 you mentioned, 541 is kind of the top right now. So if it breaks above that, then all bets are off where we could go from there.
So you just mentioned some of the funds pouring money into commodities. I mean, is that because they're just looking for some place to move their money into, or what's your sense of what's driving that?
Yeah, part of it is that they move around from different commodities, and the ag futures are in the middle of a bull market right now. So that's where where they see the safe bet, at least. And then also it has to do with just the underlying fundamentals are supportive for. As far as canola is concerned, it's a lot of the story is soybeans, but canola on its own is also seeing some solid fundamental demand. Exports are running ahead of the best they've done in a few years, if not ever to date. The first couple months of the crop year, we've seen steady export movement. The domestic crush is going full steam ahead as well. So the demand is there for canola underpinning things. And, but yeah, a lot of it has to do with beans as well. And so for soybeans, the issue is, South America, and they've had, Brazil has had a drier season this year. Right now is when they plant their soybean crop, mm-hmm. and it's been too dry for germination. And that slowed seedings. They are, the last I checked, they are expected to get some rain, or might be seeing some rain already, and that might take some of that support out of the market. But the question is, too little, too late, or what? So the eyes are on South American weather. And on the demand side for soybeans, it seems almost every day, every other day, there's a new sale, U.S. selling soybeans to China. So China's back buying U.S. beans, and they're showing a lot of strength right now.
So can we talk about that for a second? So, I mean, my understanding is that, China's pig herd is, much, much smaller than it was a couple of years ago. Therefore, they should be buying, less imported beans and imported feed. Why are they still buying beans? Like, what's driving that?
Well, part of it is, to my understanding, the African swine fever did decimate their hog herd, but it is coming back at a quicker than expected pace. So their hog industry is recovering from that African swine fever better than they had expected. So there's more pigs eating more soybeans and corn earlier than had been expected. That's part of it. there's the whole kind of trade deal stuff with the states, and they, you know, agreed to buy X amount. You know, that deal is not the most solid of deals, so that may not have much to do with it, but that is kind of in the background, that at least on paper they said they would buy soybeans. So
all right, so let's move on to wheat futures. So wheat futures, I was looking at prices in Chicago, are also quite strong right now. Where is the Chicago market at right as of today?
Yeah, the Chicago futures are, they're over $6, I think like $6.30 or something even. And they're trading well above the Minneapolis spring wheat futures and above the Kansas City futures. So that in and of itself is, often Chicago's the cheaper of the wheats, but it's been strong. It's been showing a lot of strength, and some of that same as with the oil seeds fund money coming in for Chicago. The Minneapolis still has a net short from the fund position, but also it has to do with just dryness in a number of wheat growing areas of the world. The U.S. plains, they're on the dry side as their winter wheat is being seeded there. And more importantly, Ukraine, Black Sea region, that's been getting a lot of play in the futures lately, that it's too dry for their winter wheat crops as they're going into dormancy. So that's kind of been the catalyst for some of the strength. But at the end of the day, there's no real shortage of wheat in the world. So the how long wheat can keep going higher remains to be seen, I would think.
Right. Well, Phil, I can hear my dog barking in the background here, trying to get in. So we better cut this short, but thank you for coming on Between the Rows. I've been speaking with Phil Franz Workington, a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's edition of Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer. Thanks for listening.
Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.